Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, it's Michael Lewis here, and this is Judging Sam. For the past few months, we've been covering the story of Sam Bankman-Fried. He's the founder of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX. It was worth billions of dollars before it came apart at the seams. I wrote a book about all this and Sam called Going Infinite and reported on his trial here on the podcast. He was found guilty of fraud and conspiracy, and his sentencing is scheduled for later this week. Meanwhile, FTX has been going through bankruptcy proceedings. And in a surprising twist, FTX's lawyers recently announced that all the creditors will likely be paid in full. All the FTX customers who couldn't get their money out when FTX collapsed will probably get their money back. But my guest today argues that the bankruptcy process has been handled badly. His name is Jonathan Lipson. He's a bankruptcy expert at Temple University, and he co-wrote a research paper about the FTX bankruptcy that will be published next year in the Stanford Law Review. So Sam Bankman-Fried has been tried, convicted, and is going to jail, and everybody's been paying attention to that. And that is seems to be the human drama. But there's this whole other legal process, the bankruptcy process, that's getting very little attention and that you've written about. Why is it important?
It's important for a number of reasons. You know, it is important because we're concerned about how the bankruptcy was run for the benefit of, you know, creditors and investors and so on. There are millions of people who have lost money in this company. And if it was handled properly, perhaps they would do better. Number two, it appears that the bankruptcy process itself and the company itself were, you know, in effect, accelerating and perhaps distorting the criminal prosecution. And, you know, like, that's a really serious problem because we have certain legitimate expectations about how prosecutors do their job. And for that matter, we have certain basic expectations about how lawyers are supposed to act.
So let's just back up. Can you just tell me what caught your eye in the first place? Let's start there. Like, what caught your eye?
A lot of my work involves bankruptcy. I research it, I write about it, teach it. And really, I had no particular interest in crypto at all. I was interested in FTX only because it was the kind of a bankruptcy where you would have expected to see something that I had studied in the past, an examiner. The idea being that when Congress created the bankruptcy code, they said, in some cases, you really need somebody from the outside to come in and conduct an investigation of what happened and write a report about it for the public. In FTX, the United States trustee had sought an examiner at the beginning of the bankruptcy case. And to my surprise, and I think the surprise of some folks, the bankruptcy judge said no. And we can talk more about why it was surprising. But the short answer was that when the U.S. trustee sought to appeal that decision to the Third Circuit, I agreed to write an amicus brief in support of the U.S. trustee, basically seeking to have an examiner appointed. we won in the Third Circuit. And, you know, there was, as you probably know, your listeners probably know, an examiner has been appointed in the case as of a couple of days ago.
I doubt our listeners do know, because it's all so arcane, and it's been striking to me how little attention the bankruptcy has gotten compared to the rest of the case. So actually, let's go into a little more detail. Why would you have expected in this case for there to be an examiner? Back up even further than that. Just explain what the checks are on the bankruptcy process generally. Like how we did this with your co-author David Skeel, but let's do a little refresher. Like a company goes into bankruptcy, then what happens?
So, you know, to take a step back, bankruptcy in the U.S. is for companies like FTX that are purporting to reorganize. The basic intuition that Congress had in the 1970s was, well, we shouldn't just kill the company and sell off the assets to pay the creditors. If we can avoid it, because if we can keep the company going, then everybody's probably going to be better off. We'll save jobs. The company will make more money because it'll be profitable, maybe, if it returns to profitability. And, you know, it's just much better than what used to happen, which was a liquidation. But Congress realized that, you know, if you allow the company to stay in business, even when it's in bankruptcy, then maybe the guys who got the company into trouble are still running the roost. And maybe that's not so great. So they said, look, in large cases, in cases where we have any concerns about what happened before bankruptcy, an examiner should be appointed, should be mandatory, right? The statute says an examiner shall be appointed in a certain class of cases. And the reason I got involved in all this in part is because, you know, I did a study on these guys many years ago because everybody sort of knew it didn't really happen the way Congress expected.
How did it not happen the way Congress expected? What was different?
What was different is that, you know, while debtors and creditors fight all the time about all sorts of things, there is one thing they agree on, and that is that they hate examiners.
Huh.
They don't want somebody coming in from the outside, poking around in their negotiations. Because basically, a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is just a protracted negotiation in the shadow of a court with some procedural rules that are designed to facilitate that negotiation.
Right.
So an examiner is a problem for that, right? Because the examiner is coming in from the outside, maybe, you know, asking questions of management that management doesn't necessarily want to answer. Maybe, you know, interfering with or distracting from the negotiations that are happening, and certainly costing money, right?
Yeah.
The examiner doesn't work for free. The government doesn't pay the examiner. The examiner is paid really ultimately by creditors.
Right.
In the same way that all of the folks who run the bankruptcy are ultimately paid by creditors.
Right.
So, you know, if you think about it kind of intuitively, the folks on the ground who run these cases are lawyers who see each other all the time in different cases. And, you know, they fight sometimes and they get along sometimes, but what they don't want is an outsider like, for example, Bob Cleary, the prosecutor who's now been appointed to be the examiner in FTX, coming in from the outside and saying, actually, let's do a little forensics here and see what actually happened. And so even though Congress said, oh, well, you know, we should have these, you know, examiners routinely as a, you know, a way of serving the public interest in understanding what happened, like nobody ever asks for them. And, you know, frequently judges say, yeah, we know the statute requires it. But, you know, when in those rare cases they're asked, they've often said no. But the one exception that we found in our research was, well, look, when there's a massive free fall case like Enron or Lehman Brothers or WorldCom or any of these, you know, then, you know, all the inside guys are like, well, right, we get it. Like, you do need somebody to come in and explain what the hell happened.
Yeah.
And so in FTX, you're like, well, that certainly looks like that, right? It looks like Lehman or Enron or something. So that's why it was surprising that you didn't see an examiner appointed in FTX. Although, you know, the explanation that was given at the time was, well, you know, Bankman-Fried had given up control of the company to a guy named John Ray, who I'm sure we'll talk about, who clearly was independent of Bankman-Fried and who was a bankruptcy expert. He'd done a lot of work in a lot of cases. And so if you think that, you know, an examiner is just going to be independent of prior management, you know, Ray is that guy.
Right.
I think the bigger problem, and certainly the one that we focus on in the paper that we've just released, is the law firm of Sullivan & Cromwell, who had been company counsel for certain purposes before bankruptcy, brought Ray in. And, you know, as far as we can tell, had a very specific set of interests in seeing how the bankruptcy was going to proceed. And so maybe they weren't quite as independent in a problematic way from Bankman-Fried as you would have thought.
My understanding, and this is from interviewing John Ray, is that
Sullivan and Cromwell, who had been Sam Bankman-Fried's lawyers before the bankruptcy in good times, had found John Ray to come in and take over from Sam Bankman-Fried. And then the minute Sam Bankman-Fried signs the documents handing the company to John Ray, he hires Sullivan and Cromwell to run the bankruptcy. And that's going to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Sullivan and Cromwell. Is that right?
I think that's mostly correct. I mean, I think that, you know, the kind of, there are three different versions of the story about this law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And just to be clear, like, we are not out to get Sullivan and Cromwell. We're not out to fight the verdict. Like, we just want to understand what happened here. But, you know, there's a little bit of detail in all this, but, you know, Sullivan and Cromwell was clearly doing important work for FTX before bankruptcy. And it was mostly work involving the acquisition of other companies like Ledger X and other subsidiaries, and even more importantly, representing FTX in dealings with regulators, in particular the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which was super important for FTX because they wanted to, you know, establish some kind of regulatory legitimacy for crypto. And it was really important for Sullivan and Cromwell because they're one of the premier firms at interacting with regulators. Many of the folks at the firm were former regulators themselves. And, you know, they're an extremely well-regarded firm precisely because they do that stuff really well. And, you know, I think that the short version of the story is that Sullivan Cromwell didn't probably know about the underlying problems at FTX until November 8th of 2022. But they were telling the world that everything was fine. They were implying that actually they did know everything they needed to know to say to the CFTC and to creditors and contract counterparts. FTX is rock solid, in the words of one of the Sullivan Cromwell lawyers. And I think probably on November 8th or around then, they woke up to the fact that things were not rock solid, that there was a problem because the company was commingling assets, even though Sam had promised everybody that would never happen.
What is commingling?
It simply means that FTX and Bankman-Fried had promised depositors that their crypto would be held by FTX. It would be on the FTX exchange and nobody else would have it. But that turned out to be false for some very important number of depositors because it ended up at a related company known as Alameda. And that was, you know, a big problem because Alameda used the money for all these other purposes that obviously depositors didn't expect. And so, you know, I don't know that the most sort of, nefarious version of the story of Sullivan and Cromwell is true, namely that they got John Ray to come in and steal the company from Bankman-Fried. I think that's improbable, if only because Sullivan and Cromwell has tons of money already. Like, they don't really need hundreds of millions of dollars because they already have hundreds of millions of dollars. I do, however, think they might have panicked. And I think in that moment of panic did several things that we describe in our paper that I think at minimum were ethically problematic. And from our perspective, more importantly, problematic from the bankruptcy perspective, from the process, the perspective of the goals of the bankruptcy process.
And they're going on behind closed doors because there's no examiner to reveal all this. Describe those things that you think Sullivan and Cromwell did that are problematic.
Sure. So I think the first thing that happens is, you know, on November 8th, an attorney named Andy Dieterich, who's an important person in the story, is a bankruptcy lawyer, I think realizes, you know, because he gets a panic call from some lower level attorneys at FTX that there's commingling going on, that there's a real problem, that the company is having a liquidity crisis because they can't honor withdrawals. We don't know what happens internally at S&C, but we do know that the very next day, Sullivan and Cromwell does something very important, which is that they go to the prosecutors. Now, that's a problem for a couple of reasons. Number one, you're not really supposed to go to the prosecutors and rat your client out unless a couple of things are true. Number one, you're sure there's a crime, and we don't know that they had determined that. Number two, you've gone to the highest authority in the company to confirm that there's a crime and confront them and say, by the way, we think there's a crime. You should stop committing that crime. We don't think there's any evidence of that. And then number three, say to that highest authority, if you don't stop, we might have to go to the authorities because otherwise we'll be implicated in it and we don't want that. We don't see any evidence that that happened either. Quite the contrary. So the second thing that happens that's really problematic is that on that same day, November 9th, when they went to the prosecutors, the same lawyer, Andy Dietrich, sent Sam Bankman-Fried what I think is a very important email. I call it the reassurance email. And at 9:32 that evening, he sends Sam an email basically saying, look, we are here to help you in your efforts to rescue FTX however we can. And that meant something very specific because basically Sam's view of life, as far as I can tell, was he thought there was just a liquidity crisis. And that crisis could be solved by finding more liquidity, finding new loans, which is normally what happens when companies have liquidity crises, but are otherwise basically sound. So Sullivan Cromwell, this attorney, Mr. Dietrich, sends Sam this email saying, we're here to help you do that however we can. And, you know, by the way, we need you to sign a contract to hire John Ray. He'll come in as what's known as the chief restructuring officer, a CRO, which implies that Sam would remain the CEO, the chief executive officer. Sam, we want you to remain director. Sam, we want you to continue to go out and find resources for the company, you know, financing for the company. Sam, you know, the bankruptcy, if it happens at all, it's just an alternative and it's a couple of weeks away. But we need to be ready. And here are some things that we need you to do. All very normal things to say to a client that is facing a liquidity crisis and may have to go into bankruptcy, but not what you say to a client who you think has committed crimes. And when you've already, you know, without the knowledge of that client, gone to the prosecutors to inform the prosecutors, apparently, that there were crimes ongoing. So to me, the second big problem, and in some ways, you know, I don't know if it's the biggest, but it's a really big one, is what I appears to us to have been deception. Now, maybe it turns out that there's more to the story than we know. Maybe Sam knew. Sam has, you know, I talked to him. He said, no, absolutely not. We had no idea. He did have his own lawyers by this point. Right? Paul Weiss was involved. And, you know, I don't know if they knew or not. If they did, there's a different kind of problem. But in any case, you know, that this reassurance email, I think, is all in service of getting Sam to do the thing that he did then in the early morning hours, I guess the 11th of November, which is sign over not just control of the company, but all of his powers, you know, having anything to do with the company to John Ray, which, you know, ends up being, I think, from Bankman-Fried's perspective, disastrous.
Given how that it's unusual that Sullivan and Cromwell would have gone to the prosecutors right away, do you have any thoughts about why they might have done that?
I do. I think that that's, to me, most consistent with a story of panic. I think they correctly view themselves as being really important intermediaries between large, important regulated companies and the folks who regulate those companies. And if you've been making a significant mistake with those regulators for a while with a prominent company, and you wake up one morning and realize that, like, maybe you panic. Maybe that's a problem for you. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a variety of ways you could fix that. They could have, you know, withdrawn and perhaps tried to ameliorate that with the regulators. And maybe they even did that. We don't know, because although they had filed an application for FTX with the CFTC, they withdrew it the same day that the company went into bankruptcy, the 11th of November, and nobody's ever seen it since then. So we don't really know what else they said to the CFTC, but we know a little bit. But so I think they were just concerned about protecting their reputation. I think it's also true that, you know, Dietrich had said, like, look, we want to build a Chapter 11 practice here. We don't have one, right? We are great litigators. We're great regulatory lawyers. We're great corporate lawyers, but we should also be doing Chapter 11 work. And this might be an entree into it. More importantly, I think from a very strategic standpoint is if you're the lawyer for the company in bankruptcy, as Sullivan Cromwell is, you control the process. You control all of the information at the company. As a practical matter, unless you have a fight with management, you and management will be aligned on really everything having to do with the company. And so one of the things that we figured out very early on is that it appeared that Sullivan Cromwell and Ray were actually providing significant support to the prosecution of Bankman-Fried.
How unusual is that? I mean, the creditors are paying for that. Sullivan & Cromwell's billing the company to provide the prosecutors with information that will help them make their case against Sam Bankman-Fried. Creditors don't sign off on that. It's unclear why that's even in the creditors' interests. So how do they, is that unusual? I mean, I just don't know. Is it unusual? And yeah. If it's unusual, how is it unusual?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I want to be careful here. I mean, the creditors are represented in the case by an official committee of unsecured creditors.
Yep.
And they have their own lawyers, a firm called Paul Hastings, a very good firm. And, you know, one response you could imagine Sullivan Cromwell having to anything we have to say is, well, like, look, the creditors have lawyers and they haven't objected to it. I have never seen this level of support by a company in bankruptcy for the prosecution of its insiders. At, you know, this level, this cost, this intensity. I haven't studied it carefully because it doesn't happen much. And certainly it makes sense for the company to cooperate and to enter into some kind of plea agreement or something of some sort with the prosecutors, you know, which I think does happen fairly frequently. And part of that will, you know, undoubtedly require some cooperation. But cooperation is different from running analyses. And, you know, one of the lawyers for Sullivan and Cromwell gets up in court in, I think, February of 23 at the hearing on the appointment of the examiner, initial hearing on that, and says, you know, we've been doing tens of millions of dollars worth of work in support of the prosecution and other interactions with regulators. Well, that's shocking. That's shocking because that's tens of millions of creditor dollars that they're spending on this. And I think he thought that that was in service of the argument that we don't need an examiner because we'd have to spend tens of millions of dollars on an examiner too, which isn't really true because the examiner is really just focusing on Sullivan and Cromwell, not all the other stuff. But yeah, it was pretty surprising. It was pretty surprising, I guess.
How much control do John Ray and Sullivan and Cromwell have of the information inside of FTX? Like, how easily accessed is that information by either the prosecutors or the defense attorneys? And how hard is it to see inside and see why they're doing what they're doing?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, I think Ray, you know, is the CEO of the company and has, you know, all the powers that Bankman-Fried would have had enhanced to a certain extent by the bankruptcy code.
Right.
So he controls it all. Counsel to the company, Sullivan & Cromwell, was, you know, retained by Ray. That was, I think, one of the first things he did. So they too have unfettered access to all of the company's information, all the company's resources. I think that's a lot of money, a lot of other assets. And they can decide who gets to see it and who doesn't. So, for example, I think they decided to let the prosecutor see, you know, if not all of it, a great deal of it, and to perform significant analyses. That's certainly what Bankman-Fried's lawyers alleged in the criminal case, and that we've seen some evidence of that independently. But they're not obligated to share it with anybody else if they don't want to. So they haven't, for example, allowed Bankman-Fried access to any of the information, as far as I can tell, at all, which creates a very basic problem in criminal law, which is a little outside of my expertise. But basically, you know, the concern that was raised in the criminal trial is, look, the government has a duty to provide what's called or exculpatory information, evidence that, you know, they have that would exonerate Sam. The government has that duty, but other private actors don't have that duty. And so the fight in the criminal trial in part was about whether FTX had the duty to provide exculpatory evidence to help Sam's defense. And the answer was no. Right? They didn't have to do that and didn't do that. And so it's not at all difficult to imagine that the prosecutors were like, this is awesome. This is the best thing that's ever happened to us because we have really smart lawyers and other people to analyze this stuff. And we don't have to share hardly any of it unless we choose to with the defense. It's like ka-ching, like it's awesome for the prosecutors, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's, and you can imagine that, and I don't mean, you know, cast aspersions on the prosecutors. Like, I think they have very good reason to want to take advantage of this, right?
They want to win.
Exactly. Right.
Your paper pointed out something that had not, it's an idiocy of mine, had not occurred to me. And that was that the check on the bankruptcy process is the Department of Justice, the person in the bankruptcy, the right. Trustee is an employee of the Department of Justice. But it's right. Also the Department of Justice that's bringing the case against Sam Bankman-Fried. And so you that's wonder right. What happened between when you see the trustee not pressing really hard for an examiner or not making a huge stink when the examiner is not appointed. You wonder what conversations occur within the Department of Justice on this subject.
That's a great point. And yes, I mean, we, you know, the subtitle of the paper is conflicts of, you know, public and private interests in Chapter 11, because, you know, it's easy enough to say, well, it looks like there might be some evidence that Sullivan and Cromwell had a kind of private conflict of interest. They didn't want any of their mistakes, you know, before bankruptcy to be revealed. And so they're, yep. You know, use the bankruptcy to conceal that. But it's also apparently the case that there was some kind of conflict between the public actors here, as you point out. So the U.S. trustee program is the watchdog for the bankruptcy system. And they're not the only people who can ask for an examiner, but they did here, and they often are the ones who do. they're the ones who are supposed to police for conflicts of interest. And they did object to Sullivan Cromwell's retention, but I'm not sure they knew any of the stuff that we've, you know, now put forward. But at the same time, the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney Program is part of the Department of Justice. And it's not at all difficult to imagine that there were tough negotiations between them, because if the prosecutors are getting really important support from FTX and Sullivan Cromwell, you know, who have a very large and very well-respected white-collar practice, maybe the U.S. attorneys in New York don't want anybody to toss Sullivan Cromwell out on grounds that they have some kind of conflict. Maybe you don't want an examiner coming in and poking around to figure any of that stuff out. So there's a tension. There's a kind of conflict, we think, between the U.S. trustee, who wants this transparency and wants this stuff to come out because that's their job, and the prosecutors, who under these circumstances, which we think are probably unusual, to say, no, this is like a really good thing. Do not mess it up. And, you know, obviously, we have no idea if that's really true, although we have good reason to think it is. Certainly, we have no idea how it gets resolved, because there is no rule book for resolving those kinds of, you know, internal disputes in the Department of Justice, at least not one that's public.
Judging Sam will be right back.
As listeners of this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert teams of nerds have the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
We're back. So there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about. It seems it's one of the unusual things about the FTX bankruptcy is just how many assets were still there. It's sounding more and more like the depositors are going to get all their money back with interest. They're sitting on a pile of many, many billions of dollars of assets. And is that unusual? Is it unusual for the bankrupt company to have such wealth inside of it? And is that querying in any way the way the bankruptcy might be conducted? Like, does it, for example, create an incentive to string it out longer because you can actually bill so much more because the money is there?
Yeah. So put that incentive question to one side, because that is the right question, and we'll come back to it in a second. You know, the crypto cases are kind of unusual because, you know, these firms, especially the exchanges, seem to look a little bit like banks, but they weren't regulated like banks. And banks themselves are not allowed to go into bankruptcy for a good reason. Like it would totally screw up the system if they could. You know, I think most companies, when they go into bankruptcy, that have, you know, any real business that's going, you know, they're not going to be solvent and they're not going to pay creditors in full, but they'll pay them something. Probably they will pay them, you know, partially in cash and partially in stock of the company. They'll issue new stock and they'll, you know, wipe out the old shareholders. which is intuitive, right? Like, all right, well, you know, the old shareholders took the risk and they lost. You know, the kinds of assets that it appears all, that FTX was sitting on, you know, like Anthropic stock, like all that stuff seems extraordinary to me. I think you called it in your book, the Dragon's Lair, which I thought was such a colorful, you know, way of capturing this strange collection of assets, many of which turned out to be quite valuable, that Alameda or, you know, other entities in the complex were holding onto. And that's highly unusual. The other thing to bear in mind is that even though the company has said, well, we think that customers may get their deposits back, they've said that the value of those deposits has been determined as of the date of the bankruptcy petition.
Correct.
Which is November 11th, when the value of those deposits was quite a bit lower.
Right.
So
well, they
what
all
that
got,
means
they,
is
they, you, all, they all got dollarized then. It was sort of like, if you had crypto, you got the dollar value equivalent, and that's what you're going to get back. So you
right. And that's very different from actually getting your crypto back. Because
correct.
Today, that crypto is, it sounds like it's worth a great deal more than it was back then. And so, you know, if in fact it was your crypto always, even if the company was commingling it, it should just be your crypto. They should just give it back to you. And if it's worth more, mazel tov. And if it's not worth more, well, it's too bad for you. But neither way, right? The company is getting the delta there. The company
right.
is getting the delta there. And that in part is presumably subsidizing everything else that's happening on top of the fact that the company did have all of these assets, some of which look like they were extremely valuable. Now, your question about incentives is the right one, which is like, well, who's got what incentives here? You know, ordinarily in a reorganization, the lawyers always get paid off the top and, you know, people grouse about it, but it's not a big deal because otherwise, how are you going to get it done, right? You can't. And so, you know, the company makes sure that its plan to reorganize has, you know, sufficient cash built into it to make sure that those lawyers get paid. But mostly the money is going to go to keep the company going. One of the most troubling things in the bankruptcy here is that it doesn't really look like Ray ever honored the promise that Diederich had made to Bankman-Fried back in November 9th of 2022, which is like, we're here to help you rescue this company. And, you know, that would presumably have involved finding new financing to, you know, provide the liquidity that you needed to permit withdrawals to start again and to then keep going. Because if the company was fundamentally profitable, but have this, you know, serious problem. I don't think anybody disputes there was a serious problem of commingling.
Right.
But you've stopped that problem and you've found ways to fix it. And otherwise, these exchanges are pretty viable. Like the most value for the most people would come from keeping the business going.
Yeah.
And one of the other remarkable things about the examiner hearing, again, from, you know, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, is that Ray testifies extensively and he says, I never talked to Bankman-Fried.
Yeah, he told me
what?
That I couldn't, that blew my mind too, because he and the other executives are trove of information. You would think you'd want right. the information, but he told me
for
he
sure.
didn't, as a matter of principle, he said he didn't speak to him.
Very early in the case, because what did Sam do in the middle of November of 2022? He did what Sullivan and Cromwell encouraged him to do and what he thought he should be doing, which was trying to find rescue financing. So he goes out and he gets, I don't know, Tron and Nomura and who knows, you know, all these other folks to say, yeah, we'll lend you $3 or $4 billion. Now, I have no idea if those were worth the paper that they were written on. I just don't know. I do know that your job as the CEO of the company in Chapter 11 is to at least figure it out.
Yeah.
Right? Take a look at them, say, are these good or not? Like, Sam, tell me about these things. We understand you might have some other issues, but at least like, you know, make the connection, help us understand how we can do this. And they didn't do that. And that to me is extraordinary, right? It's extraordinary for a couple of reasons. One being that like, if the point of having this whole system Congress created in the 70s is to keep viable companies going, then for whatever reasons, a decision was made to not do that. Now, we don't know obviously internally what was going on, and they definitely made, they being FTX and Sullivan & Cromwell, made some, you know, statements about possibly restarting the exchanges. So maybe they tried. I know ultimately they didn't and they just blamed it on Bankman-Fried. But again, if Ray was correct when he said, well, this is just old fashioned embezzlement, and we know factually everybody agrees that there was commingling between Alameda and FTX, and that I think that was stopped, then like this was a simple problem and that the criminal part of it was solved a while ago or very easily. So why not restart the exchanges if you think they're fundamentally sound. Like this problem, it was like, you know, it was like a benign tumor. It was a tumor. It had to be taken out, but it was benign and there was no reason to think that it metastasized.
And so getting back to you, why wouldn't they have done that? What are their incentives?
On the incentives, I think there are sort of two conflicting ones. One is the one kind of on the surface that you identify, which is like, well, you know, the lawyers can make lots and lots of money in the case by billing. And so, in fact, they have. I mean, the billing rate in the case has been extraordinary. So that's on the surface. But as I said earlier, like, I don't think Sullivan Cromwell was interested in stealing the business from Bankman-Fried from like to make money on it, right? I mean, like, they don't need the money. I think they were concerned about embarrassment. I think they wanted to maintain good relations with the government and public actors. And number two, and this is a little more subtle, you know, you can imagine that Sullivan Cromwell sort of shows up at the prosecutor's office on November 9th and says, we know you've been concerned about crypto for a while. We've got a story to tell you. And then, you know, maybe the prosecutors were already thinking about it and investigating, whatever. But they come to realize that, like, there's this incredibly fortuitous set of events that can make it possible for Sullivan and Cromwell to really be heroes to the prosecutors that they work with all the time, to be heroes to the regulators who they might have, you know, misled a little bit earlier, but who they've now made, you know, functional amends with. And by the way, we get to build a Chapter 11 practice along the way. So I think those are the kinds of incentives that are more plausibly at work. But again, you know, there's more to the story and we don't know what that story
is. But why does that lead to not trying to restart the company as a going enterprise?
Right. Because if you restart the company as a going enterprise, it comes out of bankruptcy sooner. And I think more information about the company comes out sooner. What I think is going to happen is if, you know, FTX and Sullivan and Cromwell are able to do what they want to do, they're going to liquidate the company and seal all the records.
So no one will ever know what happened.
Correct. And so if you reorganize the company instead and it survives as a going concern, oh, guess what? They're going to be managers and they're going to be shareholders and they're going to be other human beings interacting with this large company. And they're going to learn all sorts of stuff that might not be so great for Sullivan and Cromwell. Mostly about what happened in that moment of panic, if it was in fact a moment of panic, and then thereafter, because there were many, many puzzling decisions made during the bankruptcy case that are hard to explain, except perhaps as a way of helping Sullivan Cromwell manage these other problems, which is, you know, if we're right, is a very, very big problem. All of that would come out eventually if the company were reorganized.
As listeners of this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert teams of nerds have the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
So the Court of Appeals reversed the bankruptcy judge on the subject of the examiner. How unusual is that? How unusual is it for a Court of Appeals to say, to tell the bankruptcy judge, no, you did it wrong?
So it was. This is the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is, you know, very sort of well-regarded, powerful court. I don't think the reversal rate, I don't think it was that unusual, especially in this case, because the statute is clear.
It's so obvious. Right? It's so obvious.
Right. And so to me, part of what's so interesting about this, and I don't know the answer, is why Sullivan & Cromwell didn't just settle this request for an examiner back when the U.S. trustee made the request. Because if I'm Sullivan & Cromwell, like, I should be like, sure, we have nothing to hide here, guys. There's no problem here. Bring an examiner and, like, let's keep it focused on, you know, you're concerned about our conflict. We have no conflict. We got nothing to hide from you. And keep it short, keep it sweet, keep it focused, all of which they could have done by agreement with the U.S. trustee. And that, like, if I'm Sullivan Cromwell, that's a total win. Because you can say, hey, we had an examiner. We're all fine. Like, he gave us a clean bill of health. Nothing to see here, guys. And by the way, if that had happened, I wouldn't be here.
Right. An attorney named Bob Cleary has been appointed as the examiner. And I'm curious what happens next. Is he a genuinely independent person? Or is he a bankruptcy person who's a repeat player in the bankruptcy system?
No, definitely not that. He was the prosecutor, apparently the prosecutor who prosecuted the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski.
Oh.
When he was a prosecutor.
All right.
And now he's a white collar, criminal defense lawyer at Patterson Belknap. Is not a bankruptcy insider. If I had to guess, I would say he's probably very independent. I think the bigger question about Cleary is going to be how much access he really has to what really happened. And it's not at all difficult for Sullivan Cromwell and FTX to throw sand in his gears.
How would they do that? How would they do that? He doesn't have the right to walk in and ask for anything.
I have not seen the final order on the scope of his retention, but unless it orders the company to waive privilege and, you know, gives him access to everything, even if it's been designated confidential, he's going to have to ask for it. And the company absolutely can fight about things like privilege, attorney-client privilege, and can absolutely fight about things like confidentiality. My guess is that at this point, Sullivan & Cromwell probably won't fight too hard, certainly not openly. I mean, they were fighting the examiner tooth and nail until a couple of weeks ago. And then they seem to have stopped. So I think they understand that, you know, they should just sort of, you know, like take the medicine and deal with it. But they can still, you know, fight in sort of small ways. And whether Cleary has the resources, meaning basically the money, the budget from the bankruptcy court, you know, really from the company, whether the bankruptcy court has the patience to deal with challenges by Cleary to whatever Sullivan Cromwell may or FTX might be withholding. You know, those are questions that will have to be answered. He's going to produce a report in fairly short order. My hunch is that it will say something like this. You know, we've investigated. We couldn't get everything we wanted to see. We saw a lot. We think there's some problems. This is not great. But, you know, mostly the problems that we've seen would involve claims of, you know, an ethical nature having to do with Bankman-Fried, and they don't really affect the bankruptcy. The scope of our retention really doesn't ask us to look at the whole bankruptcy and everything else. So, you know, unless the judge wants to do a fuller thing, you know, we're not really going to say, but we'll wag a finger at Sullivan Cromwell and we'll let it go. Now, that's not great, but it wouldn't be terribly surprising. That's why we say in the paper, we think that most of the damage has been done and can't be undone.
Do you have any idea whether Bob Cleary has read your paper?
Not a clue.
Should, right? I mean, if he reads your paper, he's going to be able to ask some questions that it might not occur to him otherwise.
Absolutely. And for that matter, Sullivan Cromwell should read it, right? I mean, like, you know, we are not hiding anything from them. They may well have a different version of the facts than we have. Undoubtedly, they do. Undoubtedly, they know more facts than we know. And if they think we have gotten something wrong, if they think we are missing some important things, like, they should tell us. Like, you know, we're not here to get anybody. We're just here to get the truth.
How did talking to Sam directly and his mom affect your view of the case?
Yeah, that's a great question. I, you know, got connected to them initially through a colleague of mine at Stanford who's, you know, called me after I'd already agreed to do the amicus brief to say, you know, can I tell you this crazy story and ask you a favor? And he told me, you know, basically Sam's version of the Sullivan Cromwell stole the company from me story. And I was like, yeah, that can't be right. That's nuts. He's like, well, look, would you talk to them? Would you do me a favor and talk to them about this? I'm like, of course, I'll talk to anybody. I can't be the lawyer, but I'll talk to anybody. And I did talk to them. And, you know, he sent me, they sent me the, you know, all the stuff that Sam was sending to everybody about this. And over time, I came to appreciate that there was more to the story than just Sullivan Cromwell's version of it.
Do you come away from this experience thinking that the bankruptcy system needs to be reformed?
That's a great question. So, you know, David and I do have some pretty concrete recommendations in the final part of the paper. Like, we think maybe, you know, we should use examiners a little more frequently on a somewhat more targeted basis. Because again, you need this kind of outside check, we think, in a broader class of cases. We absolutely think that judges should take much more seriously questions about whether the lawyers for the company, who have so much control and power in these cases, really had any pre-bankruptcy relationships here, you know, or in any case like this. And it's, you know, it's tricky because, you know, every large firm has done something for every large company. So they'll have always had some kind of relationship. Not always, but frequently. It's not hard to imagine. But you really, you know, need to like take a beat if you're the judge, think about like, okay, exactly what's going on here. So, you know, we think judges should be more mindful of this kind of problem. We think that you should use examiners a little bit more. We think the U.S. trustee should probably have more independence in the Justice Department or from the Justice Department, maybe be housed outside. You know, the truth is the U.S. trustee is often the only person coming into the bankruptcy court and saying like, hey guys, we think there's a problem here. Can you please slow this down? And, you know, I think sometimes the judges feel like the U.S. trustees are just kind of meddlesome bureaucrats and they don't maybe, you know, get quite the deference that they deserve. You know, here they were, I think, onto something very important, even though they were limited in what they could do because of the relationship with the prosecutors.
The paper was great. It's very, very, I mean, for this kind of thing, it was a page turner. So congratulations.
Well, that is very kind of you. Thank you.
Jonathan Lipson is a bankruptcy expert at Temple University. And as for Sullivan and Cromwell, all I can say is that a spokesperson for Sullivan and Cromwell referred me to a statement from the FTX debtors, which reads as follows, quote, in an effort to support Mr. Bankman-Fried at the expense of his victims and the dedicated professionals who have worked tirelessly to rectify the harm he caused, certain academics and others have parroted his false narratives, certain of which cite their source as being interviews with Sam Bankman-Fried and his parents, in an attempt to elevate his standing and image before the court that is about to sentence him. In fact, but for the work of a large team of committed advisors, including Sullivan and Cromwell, and others who have been unfairly maligned as part of Mr. Bankman-Fried's defense strategy, billions of additional dollars would have been lost or stolen, and the recoveries to customers would be a fraction of what we can now expect. It's time to put blame where it rightfully belongs. And coming up on Judging Sam, I'll be in court for a sentencing, and I'm also going to speak to a former federal prosecutor and possibly Sam Bankman-Fried himself. Judging Sam is hosted by me, Michael Lewis. Lydia Jean Cott is our court reporter. This episode was produced by Ariella Markowitz and edited by Jacob Goldstein. It was engineered by Sarah Brugger. The music was composed by Matthias Bossi and John Evans of Stellwagen Symphonette. Judging Sam is a production of Pushkin Industries. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to access bonus episodes and listen ad-free, don't forget to sign up for a Pushkin Plus subscription at pushkin.fm/plus or on our Apple show page. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.